Good evening, everyone. Shavua Tov. My name is Dov Altman. I'm the Executive Vice President for Canadian Friends of Bar-Ilan University, and I'd like to welcome you all tonight. And I'm really thrilled that Bar-Ilan can join with Torah in Motion in putting on such a wonderful evening. Really, you know, I just came back from being a month in Israel at Bar-Ilan University, and this whole topic tonight and what we're going to be discussing, what we're going to be hearing from some of the best, is really talking about inclusion. And that's the one thing that I saw that when we were at Bar-Ilan, and what the essence of Bar-Ilan University is all about, and it is inclusion. And it is the future and the strength of the Jewish people. So we're thrilled to be able to share with some of our brightest and best from Bar-Ilan with you this evening. And I'd like to thank Torah in Motion for allowing us and giving us the opportunity of joining with them for such a wonderful evening. So thank you for coming. I welcome you all, and I'd like to introduce Rabbi Jay Kelman. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Shavua Tov. Just I want to thank everybody for coming, Bar-Ilan. As I mentioned last week at our conference, I really want to thank all the institutions in Toronto, the many shuls and the schools who have worked with us over the years. In the past couple of weeks, up to over 2,000 people have attended live programs in the month of November alone. Thank you very much. It's really been a very exciting month. And tonight I really want to just make a special mention. You know, we started a few years ago our online learning e-team, Electronic Torah in Motion, Kavata e-team, Litera, however you want to say it, e-team. We've had, you know, hundreds of classes online, interactive classes. People can talk, ask questions. People from all over the world, all across North America, Australia, Hong Kong, Israel, Europe, have been on these classes. And tonight we're going really a step further, and we are webcasting this. As you can see, the camera's all over the place, the light. So I just want to make a special welcome to all the people who are watching online. There were over 100 people registered when I left about an hour ago, when I last looked, and they were coming in fast and furious. I really want to thank all the people online, and I want to welcome them, especially people in Teaneck, New Jersey, Rinat Yisrael, a congregation under the leadership of Rabbi Adler, in Chicago, Illinois, congregation Anshe Shalom, Asher Lopatin, Rabbi Asher Lopatin, in Skokie, Illinois, Rabbi Tzvi Engel, and a congregation Or Torah. And even though it's still just ending Shabbos, but I want to thank Rabbi Alesker Muskin of Young Israel of Century City in L.A. I want to thank all the shuls for really for helping and partnering and bringing our program here, so not only live in Toronto, but people watching online. And I want to thank you for all your help over the years and continued participation. And with that, I'll welcome you, Shavua Tov, and I'll let Elliot take over for the panel, and enjoy the evening. Thank you very much.
Good evening. My name is Dr. Elliot Malamut. There is a general sense in the Orthodox world that we live in a time of unprecedented opportunities and choices for Jewish women in the realm of Torah study, as well as in communal leadership, including choices about the rabbinate, involvement in communal prayer, and other domains. Now, discussions about these matters throughout the community are often passionate and even heated, a testimony to the significance and centrality of the issues involved. The evolution in women's role goes back decades. As one of our distinguished panelists, Professor Freemer, has correctly asserted, quote, many of the innovations that are taken for granted today, including women's prayer groups, Megillah readings, Hakafot, recitation of Birkat HaGomel and Mourner's Kaddish, women on shul boards, and Gemara Shirim, were already put in place at Harvard Radcliffe Hillel in the early 70s during his time as the Orthodox Rabbinic Advisor there. Two things that are well known nonetheless should be recalled in this regard. Number one is that these innovations are not taken for granted by all within Orthodoxy, not even all within modern Orthodoxy. And secondly, is that recently the ante has been upped. More dramatic changes are being pushed for and just as vociferously opposed in this realm. From the reality of partnership minyanim, in which women lain are given aliyot and lead selected parts of the service, to the skirmishes over the possibility of women assuming some kind of rabbinic position, we are now voyaging from a sociological standpoint in somewhat uncharted oceans in Orthodoxy. To that end, we felt it would be timely to address these issues, and I cannot think of four people better suited to help us navigate these waters. We will begin our discussion by briefly discussing the changes that have occurred and then move on to some analysis of specific hot points in the debate, women laning and being called to the Torah. But we will also move past these specific items to address the very notion of halachic change in modern Jewish life, especially change spurred by feminist considerations. I would like to introduce this evening's panelists, moving from this end to that end. Rabbi Dr. Daniel Sperber studied rabbinical ordination in Yeshivat Kol Torah and earned a doctorate from University College London in the departments of Ancient History and Hebrew Studies. He is currently professor of Talmud at Bar-Ilan University and serves as the rabbi of the Menachem Tzion Synagogue in the Old City of Yerushalayim. Rabbi Sperber's publication record in Jewish studies, of course, includes Minhagei Yisrael, Origins and History on the Character and Evolution of Jewish Customs. He won the Israel Prize in 1992. He has written extensively on the topic of inclusion of women in certain ritual services, especially in his work, Darka Shel Halacha, Kriyat Nashim B'Torah, Prakim V'Medineyut Psika. An English translation of much of that book can be found in this volume, Women and Men in Communal Prayer, Halachic Perspectives. Rav Sperber is married to Hannah Magnus, originally of Highland Park, Illinois, and they have 10 children, and they live in the Rova of the Old City. Rabbi Dr. Aryeh Frimmer is the Ethel and David Resnick Professor of Active Oxygen Chemistry at Bar-Ilan University. He received his rabbinical ordination from Yeshivat Eretz Yisrael and completed his doctorate in organic chemistry at Harvard. While a graduate student, he was appointed Assistant Hillel Director, serving as rabbi to the Harvard Radcliffe Orthodox Minyan from 1969 to 1974. Upon completing his PhD at Harvard, he became a postdoc fellow at the Weizmann Institute of Science before joining the faculty of Bar-Ilan in 1975. Professor Frimmer has published more than 125 scientific articles, reviews, and books in the area of active oxygen chemistry, but in addition to his scientific work, he has lectured internationally on various aspects of Jewish tradition and halakha, most prominently on religious Zionism and the status of women in Jewish law. He lives in Rehovot with his wife. They have raised four children and now have 11 grandchildren. Dr. Rivka Blau holds a PhD in English and Comparative Literature from Columbia and has taught English literature and composition at Fairleigh Dickinson University. She was the principal of Yeshiva High Schools in the New York area, High Schools for Women, for over 20 years, and is the author of a biography about her illustrious father entitled Learn Torah, Love Torah, Live Torah, a Rav Mordechai Pinchas Teitz, the quintessential rabbi. Dr. Blau is the editor of the Orthodox Forum volume, Gender Relationships in Marriage and Out. Her husband, Rabbi Yosef Blau, is the Mashgiach Ruchani of Yeshiva University. They are the parents of rabbis Binyamin, Yitzchak, and Yaakov Blau. Rachel Berkovitz lectures in Talmud, Halakha, and the status of women in Judaism at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Yerushalayim. She spent many years studying Talmud and Jewish texts in both traditional and academic frameworks at such institutions as Midrashat Lindenbaum, the Shalom Hartman Institute, and the Hebrew University, in both the Talmud and Jewish education departments. She lectures widely in both Israel and abroad on topics concerning women and Jewish law. She's the editor-in-chief and halachic editor of Tashma, Jofa's Halachic Source Guide series. She's a founding member of Congregation Shirah Hadashah and has lived in Yerushalayim for the past two decades and is the author of Boy-Girl Twins, age 10, and a daughter, age 6. Please welcome our panelists. I wanted each of you very briefly to describe what you see in a positive sense as the most significant change that has occurred in the realm of women and Judaism in your adult lifetime.
I don't think I have to say anything. I think you said it all. I think that fairly recently in the last couple of decades, finally, women have become, I think the word is empowered. I think that's the word that people use, empowered. Halakhically, religiously, they now are permitted to learn Gemara. They are now permitted to learn Halakha, and many of them do, and many of them are extremely learned, like Rachel Berkowitz as an example. And also in the area of synagogue ritual and Jewish leadership, women are beginning to come into their own. And they're no longer relegated to some sort of secondary position merely behind the mechitza.
And to my mind, the greatest change, as intimated by Rabbi Sperber, was the high-level education that women have gotten, which clearly started with Sarah Schneer between the World War I and World War II, but around the 1970s, where women started learning Torah Shebaal Peh, and this accelerated into high-level education with the Tohanot Rabbaniyot and with the Yotzot Halacha. I think this has been one of the most exciting changes, which has really opened up women to be part of the halachic discussion. I would just like to mention one point, and that is that a little bit of knowledge is dangerous. What I've been talking about is women with high levels of education. But whether we're talking about men or women, what we need is high-level education. A little bit of education suggests to one that they know enough to paskin for themselves, and that's not always correct.
Okay. I find it interesting that we're talking about something that has become formal and communally available that has been around for hundreds of years. In learned homes, women always learned. In fact, I am named for a great-grandmother, Rebbetzin Rivka Rabinovich, Zichrona Livracha, whose answer to a shaila was published in Yagdil Torah in 1885. So I hardly think that we just started learning now. It's just that it was in learned homes, where Gemara was the whole conversation, where learning was the way of life. That has now been extended. You don't have to be Beruya David, the daughter of Rav Huttner, in order to learn Gemara. You don't have to be Atara or Tova Soloveitchik, the daughters of Rav Yosha Ber Soloveitchik, in order to learn Gemara. The question when Atara was getting married was, where was she going to find a Lamdan big enough to be an equal partner to her? Thank God that she found Rav Yitzchak Tversky, the Chrono Vracha. So this is not something that's an innovation. What's an innovation is that what is now widely available used to be limited only to learned homes. And I think it's wonderful that it's now widely available and that you can now go to a school and you don't have to depend on having a father, a husband, or a brother who is willing to teach you. I also think that formal Jewish learning began before Sarah Schneer, and we should give attention to the schools that were in Kovna, in Ponovich, in Telz, way before Sarah Schneer started working. So I think these have been forgotten, and we should be aware that there has been much more going on for much longer than we realize. I think there's always been a desire on women's part for learning. I think that has changed now. What has changed now is that it's widely available. Anyone who wants to learn can find a program and can start learning, and that's a great thing. That means more attention to halakha, more careful observance of halakha. That means that we have toanot in the Batei Din. It means we have yoatzot halakha. And I know that my daughter-in-law, Noah Jeffelson, is on the kav, is on the line, two nights a week for 3 hours at a time, answering questions from all over the world in Tarat HaMashpacha. And I think it's great that she went through a two-year program, she and tens of other women, and are now able to answer those questions. Those are good things that have been happening. I think this is an elitist discussion in one respect. We're talking about 10% of the population that cares about Torah learning. Within that percentage, a very small percent is getting the advanced education that we're talking about. And I think we really have to think through to ourselves, what are we doing? There's a group called, just let me see what the name of the group is. I just watched their website. It's called Moving Traditions. They're the ones who invented It's Rosh Chodesh, It's a Girls Thing. Now they're trying to think what to do for boys. Since in 90% of the Jewish population, boys are running away from Jewish involvement as quickly as they can. And there's a whole question, the conservative reform movements, what did we accomplish by bringing women into such prominent positions? Somehow men went out the other door. So we have to think to ourselves, we have to be very deliberate in what we do. We have to think very carefully. We want women to learn. We want women to have positions of leadership, and a great deal is going to have to change in the Orthodox community in this respect. But we have to think through very carefully before we make a change. And any halachic change, we have to open to the discussion in learned Torah circles that halachic discussions deserve. It's not one person saying something. It has to be a big discussion of all the Talmidei Chachamim and Talmidot Chachamot before we make a change.
Okay, I'm clearly the youngest one on this panel, and so I can't actually say that Talmud Torah was the biggest change in my lifetime because I grew up in Boston and went to Maimonides and was in a co-ed Gemara Shir, and it wasn't until I came to Israel that I found out that women weren't allowed to learn. The first person I spoke to who told me you're not allowed to learn Gemara, I thought he was pulling something, like he was joking. I had no idea what he was talking about. I couldn't believe such a thing existed in Judaism, so I can't say that as the biggest change, because for me that was always part of my life, and I assumed that Torah learning was always open to women. The thing that I can say is that I have seen a change about the value and emphasis placed on this. I think that Torah learning for women is now assumed that, of course, any good girl is going to go and learn for a year in Israel. I think that nowadays, at least in the communities that I'm from, when girls have a bat mitzvah, they learn something and they produce a Dvar Torah or a Siyum or something. I did not have a bat mitzvah. I did nothing. I had a sleepover. There are many higher level institutes. When I was thinking about going to Israel, there were only three places in Israel where a woman could learn. Now there are tens, if not 100, I don't know, many, many places where women can learn. So I think, and I really think it's being valued. I hope that guys who are learning in yeshiva, when they're looking for a partner, one of the qualities they're looking for is a woman who takes Torah learning seriously. And I think that that sort of has changed. This is something we look at as a value and an expectation in women, and that, I think, is central. The second thing I want to say, and I'll say it quickly, is that I think that more Torah learning leads, you mentioned this, to more serious mitzvot observance. And in my lifetime, I've seen women take davening more seriously in the modern Orthodox world. I've seen women take mitzvot that they're exempt from. They're more lulavim in my shul than I've ever seen before. I used to be a lone lulav, not just in my shul, but when I go to visit my relatives, there are more women performing those mitzvot. And I think that when you learn Torah seriously, you want to do mitzvot, and you take that more seriously, and I think that that is enriching the entire Jewish community.
Okay, I'm going to now begin to address specific questions to specific people, and once they answer initially, the rest of the panel is invited to jump in. I'm going to start with Rabbi Sperber. Rabbi Dr. Friemer has written that innovations in Jewish law should be governed by three factors. Number one, halachic validity. Number two, motivation. And number three, public policy. I'd like us to think about these categories as they apply to women receiving aliyot. The case for women's aliyot stems famously from the discussion in Tractate Megillah, which we're not going to get into here, which seems to allow for the possibility of women receiving aliyot, but concludes they do not because of kavod hatzibur, the honor of the congregation, a phrase which, all of you know, has multiple applications in other places in the Talmud. Professor Sperber, in your writing, foremost among them in your book, Darkah Shel Halacha, you cite another Talmudic principle, kavod habriyot, human dignity, that can, under certain conditions, set aside kavod hatzibur, and thus allow, again, for the possibility of women being called to the Torah. Can you explain to us your understanding of the relationship between the two, that is to say, between congregational dignity and human dignity, and why you feel that for certain contemporary communities in Orthodoxy, kavod habriyot can override kavod hatzibur? And appended to that, a larger question, that given some of the controversy attending your argument, which you're well familiar with, how do you balance addressing the needs of a certain segment of a community with the fear that your psak will create division or schism within the larger community as a whole?
I think that we have to clarify something in advance. My arguments were built in a series of steps and layers. They first sought to examine whether this particular type of behavior within the world of Jewish ritual is permitted or not. And that meant analyzing the Talmudic phrases, the Tanaitic phrases in Masechet Megillah and in the Tosefta, and the interpretation of those texts in the early authorities. It was never my intention that we would be able to permit that which is basically prohibited. My argument sought to demonstrate that women's aliyot were basically permitted. They hadn't been practiced in the past for sociological reasons, but they were basically permitted, and I brought what I thought were cogent arguments, and Professor Friver will try to rebut them. And we have an ongoing sparring fight between us. And so, as I said, there were a series of arguments in the best Talmudic tradition and in the best tradition of responsa. You don't build an argument, especially when you're talking about something which is innovative, just based on one argument. And only the final stage of the argumentation was after I sought to demonstrate that the whole question of Kvod HaTzibur, congregational dignity, was basically irrelevant. It did not have validity in present-day society, and if it were to, then the society would be able to forego it, levater alav, according to many opinions. Only after that I suggested that there is an even more powerful notion, and that's the dignity of the individual. And if we find that in our day and age, something that probably didn't exist in the more distant past, there are women who are deeply motivated, who wish to have a greater spiritual experience, to wish to have a greater involvement in ritual, in spirituality, in prayer, then the fact that we do not permit this would constitute an affront to their dignity, to their human dignity. So I said that even if there were to be a clash between these two values, congregational dignity, and I don't think there is because I don't think it's relevant, but even if there were, congregational dignity has one sort of halachic classification, but human dignity, that is to say, kvod ha-briyot, is something much more powerful, which the Talmud says that it even overrides biblical laws. Maybe the various commentaries explain that they're not biblical laws, but rabbinic laws. But I would say that if there were such a clash between them, then congregational dignity would be overridden by personal human dignity. But as I say, that was only the final stage of a long series of arguments in which basically I try to say that we are permitting the permissible, even though it had not been practiced in the past.
I'd like to respond. I got into this field because having read Professor Sperber's, what I would call brilliant presentation, creative presentation, I wanted to know whether it was valid or not. And Professor Sperber did what a Talmud Chacham is supposed to do. He's supposed to suggest his analysis, document it thoroughly, and then wait to see where the dust falls. Unfortunately, as I've said on many occasions, Professor Sperber's suggestion was brilliant, but to my mind, an error. And I'd like your permission to go through it very briefly, because he made a brief presentation of his argument. I'd like to tell you why I think that he's an error. The first argument was that the Talmud suggestion that the reason why women can't get aliyot is because of kavod hatzibur, the honor of the community. the basic presumption of Professor Sperber is that kavod hatzibur is a social concept. It's what he said. But that can't be true, because the greatest social reprobate in Jewish law is the mamzer, the illegitimate child born out of forbidden sexual relations. And yet a mamzer can get an aliyah. According to many authorities, an eved can get an aliyah. That's a matter of dispute. But it has nothing to do with social standing. What does kavod hatzibur have to do? Kavod hatzibur has to do with the fact that women are not obligated in Kriyat HaTorah. That is the overwhelming consensus of all the Rishonim and the vast majority of the Achronim. And how does this play itself out? It says that since the men are the ones who are obligated in Kriyat HaTorah, they are the ones who should be getting the aliyot. Why is a woman getting an aliyah? Because the men say, you take the aliyah. But that's bizayon mitzvah. It's the men's obligation. It should be they who get the aliyah. Why are they passing it off to someone who's not obligated? The other reason is that since women are not obligated in Kriyat HaTorah, there is a general presumption in halakha that women should not be in the center of communal ritual when it's not necessary. If a woman has to say kaddish or birkat hagomel, or has her own obligation in making kiddush, that many poskim say is no problem, because that's her personal obligation. That's something that she's obligated to do. That's not unnecessary. But if it's a kriyat haTorah where women are not obligated, isha b'azara minayin, why should women be at the center of communal ritual? It's a tzniut concept. If it's unnecessary, uncalled for. And on those two types of things, the community cannot be mochel. The tzibur can't say, Chazal worried about bizayon mitzvah. We don't care about bizayon mitzvah. Chazal worried about these tzniut concepts. We're not worried about tzniut concepts. But Professor Sperber does one thing more, which is really very creative. He wants to apply the concept of kavod habriot, honor of the community, to defer kavod hatzibur. In my article, I suggest 9 reasons why that doesn't work. There are rules to kavod habriot. There are rules when kavod habriot can defer a rabbinic commandment. And if anybody wants to read my articles on the subject, I delineate the 9 reasons. Let me just give you one or two. My time is limited. Let me just give you one or two of the reasons. First of all, kavod habriot is where you shame someone. When I don't give you an aliyah, I haven't showed you perhaps the honor you feel you deserve, but I haven't shamed you. Kavod habriot is something that occurred in passing. What Professor Sperber is suggesting is he wants a permanent change. And the Yerushalmi says, it's l'sha achat, it can't be a permanent change. There are a variety of other reasons, but the most important reason is that if kavod habriot, if communal dignity, if the personal dignity was a value here, because it's an argument, then it would mean that any group could come along and say, you know what? The mechitza bothers us. We're going to do away with it because of kavod hatzibur. Because of kavod habriot. The fact that women don't count for a minyan for public prayer, that bothers us. We're going to do away. Is it possible that there's such a carte blanche that would do away with all of Jewish, of rabbinic Jewish ritual? I think that that is extremely problematic and unlikely.
We have a running argument between us.
And we're very good friends.
We're very good friends. I think that Professor Friedman's arguments are all spurious. The basic text in the Talmud says, Hakol olim neminyan shiva, afilu nashim, afilu ktanim. Now, that statement could not have been said if what he says is correct. That statement says that women can have aliyot. There is a continuation that says, but they shouldn't read the Torah because of Kvod HaTzibur. And that's again, we get back into the question of Kvod HaTzibur. But the mere fact that there exists a statement, HaKol Olim LeMinyan Shiva, makes it very clear that basically it's permissible. But there are other arguments to prevent it. And maybe they're policy arguments. And I believe that those arguments are not relevant nowadays. Furthermore, as he well knows, there are cases that we find in the Rishonim, which are not brought lahalacha, where women are permitted to have aliyot. The case of the Maram Rottenburg, who says that in a place where there are only Kohanim, a woman for halachic reasons could get an aliyah. It is true that other authorities do not accept this view for a variety of reasons, but he could not have said that statement if all that Professor Frimer says is correct. This is impossible for him. He was as clever as Frimer was.
Probably more.
Probably more. And we find in later sources, or in early sources, Moshe Kochavi, again, as you know, who permits within a house, within a personal, private framework, to have Aliyot Nashim LaTorah. And again, he could not have said that if all Professor Frimer's nine arguments are correct. When we find that some Achron says and makes a funny statement, he says that if a woman by mistake gets an aliyah, and I don't quite know how that happened, then she's not sent away. She keeps there. So I think that there are sufficiently clear statements that state that basically Professor Frimer's arguments are incorrect.
Let me just take 1 minute to respond. By, well, this can go on all night.
Of course.
This is your last minute.
By Professor Sperber's own admission, there is a difference between lachatchila and bediyeved, between what is normative Jewish law and what Jewish law permits in a crisis situation. By his own admission, the Gemara says women cannot get aliyot because of Kavanat Zibur. He is correct that in crisis situations where there's nobody else who knows how to lane, or they're only Kohanim, and as a result, Kriyat HaTorah would be canceled, under those outstanding crisis situations, the halacha does indeed permit women to get aliyot. However, we're talking about normative Judaism. And Chazal, for the reason that I mentioned, because of Zilzul HaMitzvah, because of its new consideration, said, we don't want this, this is forbidden. And the language forbidden is used by the Me'iri, by the Rambam, by the Smak, by the Maharil, that it is forbidden for women to get aliyot, with the proviso that under crisis situations, women could get it, but not normative Judaism.
I said we can go on all night.
It's very clear that Professor Sperber and I take this subject very seriously. And it's very clear that it involves years and years of education to be able to do what we're doing here tonight. That's because we take our Torah study very seriously. This is not a voice bar. This is not, I feel this way, I feel this way. This is a serious halachic discussion, as it should be, and as it's being carried out tonight.
I agree 100% with the last statement. what I can say is that I find something very disturbing in what Professor Frimer said. He said that women having aliyot, etc., is bizyon mitzvah. I think the women's not having aliyot is bizyon. I think it's something that's In our days, when women are learned, where they are learning Gemara, and you were one of the people who was involved in this whole process, and maybe it started off earlier, but at least what we know about it also, I know also from the 70s and onwards, this changed the whole attitude of women towards halakha. They learn, they feel they want to participate, and if we don't let them, I think that's a bizyon mitzvah. I think that the statement of Kvod HaTzibur, the way you interpret it, is absolutely impossible. I don't think that in a crisis situation you could permit something which is basically forbidden.
I'm going to, as I move on, I'm just going to make one statement here, which is that I think that, Professor Frimmer had it right on, I think that to really, we're touching on really Roche Prakim here, but to really get a sense of the argument, I highly recommend that you actually read the arguments of both men. So if you don't want to go through Professor Sperber's Hebrew book, as I said, this book contains the argument in essence and the arguments of others. Professor Frimmer correctly referred to a number of long, dense, very carefully argued and written articles that he has written over the past number of years that can be found in Tradition and in other journals. All the references bibliographically are available online, and it well behooves us to all sort of get the lay of the land as we go further. I wanted to turn to Dr. Blau, who, as I mentioned in my introduction, is in sort of has a unique vantage point here to bring to this discussion, because first of all, she grew up the daughter of Rav Pinchas Teitz, who was one of the giants of American Orthodoxy, and you were exposed in that home to both innovation and traditionalism. You also, of course, were the editor of the Orthodox Forum volume on gender relations, and you were in the very responsible job of heading Yeshiva High Schools for Girls for many years. I wanted to ask you sort of larger question about what you think is the best way of balancing off calls for fundamental change in relation to women and ritual with Orthodoxy's natural caution, I guess is the best way I put it, a caution that's bred both by a reverence for what is seen as a divinely prompted halachic process, as well as a fear of a system slowly eroding and losing its identity. How do we balance off those components?
Okay, because when Dr. Malamud, and I must quickly say, posting the Chor HaSanya, I enjoyed a Shabbos with the Malamud family immensely. When Dr. Malamud first asked me to come, he spoke in terms of what I had seen at home. And I first answered this question based on that. What I saw was innovation, but always with a consideration both for tradition and for consequences. For example, when my father, Zichron Livracha, built two new synagogues in Elizabeth, New Jersey, the first one that he built in 1947 was done in very modern decor. Everything is Danish modern in that shul, which nobody had ever seen in an Orthodox shul in New Jersey for sure. Lots of blonde wood walls. But the major innovation was the wonderful acoustics and sight lines for the women. And that was the instruction that he gave to the architect. The women must be able to see and hear everything that goes on in the shul, and there must be great lighting so that everything should be apparent, and there should be no dark section where women are somehow relegated to that section. With the next shul that he built in 1956, he went one step further, and he had the men's section 7 steps down and the women's section 7 steps up, and the two stairways next to each other. Because he wanted to demonstrate, at a time when a lot of mechitzos were being taken down in Orthodox shuls in this country, he wanted to demonstrate, we're not separating women because we think they're inferior. And we're not telling women, go upstairs, you're not downstairs in the main shul. He wanted to demonstrate that men and women both have to be responsible for the fact that we have a separation between men and women during tefillah, during prayer. In the same way, whenever there was an innovation, he was willing to debate it in halachic journals. The fact that I started learning Gemara in fifth grade together with the boys, that was the way my father ran the school, the Jewish Educational Center. The girls and the boys had equal educational opportunities. In fact, I learned even earlier than you that there were people who thought that was not true. In eighth grade, I went to a school in Brooklyn. The yeshiva and Elizabeth did not go till eighth grade at that time. And when we were given application forms for the one of two yeshiva high schools in the entire country that existed for girls at that time, and when it listed, what did you learn? So it said Chumash, Halacha, Navi, and it didn't say Gemara. And I raised my hand and I said, there's no space here for Gemara. And all the girls in the class were horrified. What are you talking about? Girls learning Gemara? What are you saying? And I came home with the revelation to my parents. I was 12 and a half years old at the time. There are people who think that girls should not learn Gemara. I was shocked. Just the opposite of the shock that many of you would now feel. And my father said to me, Rivka, don't try to answer them. He said, I'll just tell you, if the worst avla of this generation is that girls learn Gemara, this will go down as a very great generation in Jewish history. However, when he taught Gemara on the radio, it was a different opposition. He made a radio program, Daf HaShavua, that went from 1953 till 1986, teaching on Saturday night from 9 to 9:30, just the perfect time to be talking about it, teaching a part of Gemara, it wasn't exactly a daf that he covered each Saturday night, for all those years. So the objection then was, don't teach Torah Barabim. You're not allowed to teach Torah Bashuk. You can't teach Torah in the marketplace. And he had to answer that objection with a serious halakhic consideration. And it's interesting, from whom did the support come for his position that you could teach Gemara on the radio? And he was teaching Gemara in Yiddish. I don't know why they're so worried about the Goyim learning Gemara from his teaching in Yiddish. But he was supported by the Sri Deyesh, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who wrote a long tshuva agreeing with what my father was doing and saying it was absolutely permissible, and by Rav Soloveitchik. That was certainly adequate halachic buttressing for his argument. And he also welcomed women listening to the program and said many times on the program how happy it was that women were sending him questions by mail, calling on the telephone to ask him questions, and he dedicated several programs in memory of women who had made major contributions in Jewish life and who may have passed away during that week. But the discussion went on in the pages of HaPardes and HaMa'or, not just that my father made a decision. Without consideration, you have to think of what the halakhic ramifications are and what other people's positions are on this. When it came to other things, I mean, there were so many things that to me were not novel. My father got Arba Minim. He got an Esra Galula for all of us. We are five sisters, Baruch Hashem, and a brother. Everybody got his or her own Arba Minim. It was a mitzvah that he wanted us to know about, to value. And when I brought it into Barnard College and was living there during the week, many people came to bench on my Esra Galulav, and they were stunned that a girl owned one. But, of course, that was the early 1960s. Thank God that things have changed, and you now walk into shul. You see lots of girls with them. It was the same way for davening three times a day. This was something I saw my mother, my aunts, my grandmother do. So, of course, I thought that's what all women should do. Now, when it came to two innovations, my father was at first resistant. When people, young people in town, wanted an Eruv so that they could be able to take their children out on Shabbos, could take strollers to shul and that kind of thing, my father was very resistant, and many halakhically knowledgeable people were resistant. Because if you have an Eruv, people become unaware of Rishus HaRabim and Rishus HaYachid, and they may come to a new town and not even ask because they assume everybody has an Eruv, every place has an Eruv. My brother came up with a perfect solution. One Shabbos a year in Elizabeth, New Jersey, there is an announcement that the Eruv is down and that nobody can carry on that Shabbos, nobody can use a stroller on that Shabbos, and it's a way, and that's a Shabbos where in each shul, the halachos of Rosh Hashanah and Rosh Hashanah Yachid are taught, and people are taught, including the children, you must ask if there's an Eruv when you come to any new neighborhood. And that was a way of thinking through the ramifications of, don't just make an Eruv because Rabbi Gold made one in West Hempstead, and that was the first Eruv in the whole North America that had been made in so many years, and many communities followed suit without thinking. Think through, there still will be communities that will not have an Eruv, and you have to teach kids that they have to be aware. The next one was that an early minyan was requested on Friday. People have young children, Shabbos beginning 8:30, 8:40. They wanted to have an early minyan so they could come home and make Kiddush and have their children be part of the Shabbos meal. But my father was very concerned that if every shul in Elizabeth would make an early minyan and there would be no regular minyan, I don't even call it a late minyan, but no regular minyan at the regular time, what if somebody got home late on Friday? What if somebody came to the city to visit who didn't know that every shul in this city has an early minyan? You have to have one minyan, and he stipulated there's allowed to be early minyanim at every shul, but there must be one shul in town that will always have a minyan at the regular time, and he went to that regular minyan till the end of his life. Because in case somebody is not aware, you can't have a whole city have early Shabbos. Then people will be mechalel Shabbos, will violate the Sabbath without being aware of what they're doing. And he also said, in case there's somebody who's just mechalel Shabbos living in Elizabeth, let it be 1 hour less that he's being mechalel Shabbos. We're starting Shabbos later. He's having 1 hour less of violation. And the entire community understood that. And that minyan at the regular time continues. It is now going to be Zalatavis, 15 years since my father passed away. But there is still always a minyan at regular time. Six shuls, 1 minyan at regular time, but that the entire city has not accepted Shabbos. You still have time until Shkia. Don't worry about it. So I think that's the way you have to do innovations. You must think about the consequences. You must think about the ramifications. You must think about what effect will this have on the whole community. And whatever is going to be the resolution in halakhic discussion of many, many people about Rabbi Sperber's innovations, I don't think he should recommend that people should act on them until this discussion has happened. Because young people, impressionable young kids, will think they're doing the right thing, and they may be causing tremendous rifts in their families, tremendous rifts in their communities, and they're trying to do the right thing. They're such good, innocent people. And I think until this gets resolved and until there's adequate halakhic discussion, much more than just putting out a sefer, but real discussion and real resolution of the matter, I don't think people should act on it.
I just want to say, if the worst thing people say about this generation is that more women go to shul, learn how to lane, feel closer to Torah, that would be a wonderful thing for me. I mean, it's what's interesting to me about the conversation we're having here is that Talmud Torah, when you really look at the sources, the Rambam says it's usher. I mean, there are people that said it was usher, and there are explicit sources that say don't do it. And the change that happened involving it, even though it happened slowly, was a radical change. And it happened because the need was met. There was a need in the community about where the Jewish people were going and what was going to happen. And we sort of reached the point where your father can make that beautiful statement to say, if that's the worst thing. But I think there were times where people would have looked at that as a horrifying thing and a thing that could have made a schism in the community. And where will it lead? And I mean, I think there's the slippery slope is starting because women are learning Torah, because when you learn Torah, you want to do more things and you get little bits of knowledge and then there's this. But it's hard for me to make it. It's hard for me to understand why we can make a distinction between the two things. Something like this can be looked at and when there's opposition, say this is the worst thing, but we feel uncomfortable saying it about other things that also involve, I think, the majority of women that are interested in getting Aliyot are doing it out of a commitment to Torah and a love of doing mitzvot and a desire to become closer to Torah. And for me, if that's the worst thing that happens, that would be a great thing. You're worried about those boys. I'm worried about a lot of women. I'm worried about where Judaism is going, but that wasn't my question.
What I find fascinating is that when I talk to women who are, for example, in the GPAT program at Stern College, where they're spending a year or two after college and studying Gemara, and when I talk to a number of young learned women, they're not feeling this need. It's interesting to see where the need is coming from. If Dr. Sperber is talking sociologically, let's analyze sociologically who exactly is the component that is looking for this. We're talking about a major communal change. Learning Gemara is not a major communal change. Those are individual decisions.
But it was.
It
was a massive change.
How massive is it? Are there 1,000 women seriously learning Gemara in the entire world today? It's not been a massive change yet.
No. There must be 10,000.
Where are they?
In Israel, there are 40 midrashot.
Yes.
And they learn Gemara there.
And how seriously and how much does it continue and how many years?
What do you mean? My daughter was there 3 years before she was born.
Your daughter.
Not my daughter.
How many?
All her friends. They go there and they stay there for long periods of time. If you were in Israel and if you knew the situation and if you knew that there was a revolution in learning and if you'd see the number of new institutions that are coming up all the time in Bar Ilan itself, there are 900 girls that learn half a day Torah and half a day in the university.
And how many of them are interested in having Aliyot? And how many of them are interested in changing the whole nature of the Beit Knesset? How many of them? I know that in Alon Shut there has been a Daf Yomi going on for years of women. A Daf Yomi. That's a major commitment. We're not talking about girls who are not yet married, to whom who don't yet realize what kind of time commitment marriage and motherhood involve. A Daf Yomi of mothers who are day in, day out for a number of years learning Gemara, and they all, none of them, I've met these women, I've talked with these women. These are not women who are interested in the changes that you're talking about. Esti Rosenberg is running a wonderful program at Migdal Oz. Yes, she has over 100 young women learning with her every year. Esti Rosenberg is very well recognized as a leader. She's not interested in telling girls to get aliyot or to do these kinds of things. You are talking about a very small number. And I'm wondering why a change should be recommended to the entire community. Right. If this small number feels that it needs the change, let it have the change. But I find it very, very strange to recommend it for the community.
I don't know anyone who's recommending it for the entire community. I think that it's a solution for people who are in need. It's communities that are forming on their own because they're getting together around this issue. I don't think people are trying to force it upon their communities. I think it's speaking to a specific group of people. I think, unfortunately, that many, many, many women feel very disconnected from the shul and feel very disconnected from something that is a central aspect of Jewish life. So they say, I'm not interested because they're just not interested in what's going on in shul. They're already so disconnected that it doesn't interest them, it doesn't speak to them, and that to me is mamash chavol. Really?
But here we come into the whole question of why shul has become what it has become in the 21st century, and it's a shame that it has become a formality, and it has become very removed from any real meaning of the tefillah, and there are shuls where if you try to say, Dr. Malman and I had this discussion today. If you try to say, could you please be quiet? I'm trying to listen to the reading of the Torah. The person looks at you, what are you interrupting my conversation for? You're here for the reading of the Torah? That's not what I'm here for. So, yes, we have to change the whole culture of the shul. We certainly have to change the whole understanding of the tefillot. If you're saying words that you don't understand, how can they speak to you? So, yes, we have to get education out to a much wider group. But I don't see where this is going to accomplish it.
I'd like to point out that that the fact, and Rebbe Simblau is 1,000% correct, the fact that the serious women who take Limud HaGemara, learning Torah Shebaal Peh, seriously so that it's incorporated into their lives, that they don't push for innovation, is one of the great disappointments of the feminist movement. If you read Tamar Ross's book, if you read many of the other feminist writings, they predicted that with so many women learning Gemara, the halacha would change. It did not happen. The women who became committed to Limud HaTorah, the vast, vast majority of them become more committed to the system. And they are not pushing for change. They want more opportunities in Limud HaTorah. They feel frustrated. Rav Amital talked about this a great deal. They feel frustrated that there aren't positions opening up for them in Limud HaTorah. But changes in ritual is not what speaks to them. I should like also to point out that the changes that were made in Talmud Torah, suggested by Rachel Berkowitz, was led by Gedolim. Sarah Schneer, when she made these changes, was in consultation with all the Gedolim of Europe. She was encouraged by the Chafetz Chaim. There are articles demonstrating that all the Hasidic Rebbeim realized what was happening and how correct she was, and they supported her. What bothers me with the case of the changes in Aliyah is that the leading Gedolim of our generation have not been consulted. They have been turned to, and they're not forthcoming. They do not support this change. We always have to be careful when we make innovations that we're, as Professor Yishalei would say, is that we're not trying to mold Judaism in our own image. Because we have a sensitivity to issue, we want to change the halacha to be like the way we want it to be. Halacha, you have to worry about religious and halachic integrity. The way to do that is by talking to the experts of the generation. And there are many of them who are straight shooters, middle of the road, who you can talk to. And I have talked to them at great length. They do not support the innovations of Aliyah.
I just want to throw in a question here. Just a brief side point. The Professor Leibowitz is probably the last person to say he doesn't mold Judaism in his own image. But that's parenthetical. I'm a little...
I'm sorry, I wouldn't agree with that. I've read a lot of Professor Leibowitz, and I think he was a very rational person. And I think we could have prevented a lot of mistakes in Jewish life if we would have listened to him.
No, I think he's wonderful, but there's no question that he's reading a lot of things based on his own... Anyway,
he had a sardonic approach.
We're not going to have a Leibowitz forum here. I am a bit perturbed by your argument there that you are counting how many women want something. I see this as a straw man. If I asked you, if 100,000 women tomorrow said they wanted Aliyah, would you change anything you wrote in your articles?
The answer is no.
Okay, so
because
then it's
I believe in halachic integrity. Let me tell you,
that argument has no standing.
No, but Professor,
let me explain. This is a very important point. In 1972, I was one of the first rabbis involved in women's prayer groups. In 1972, women's Megillah readings and the like. I've been in a halachic feminist for generations, and there are people here who were with me at Harvard Hillel who can testify to the very many innovations that I instituted. But through it all, I was concerned about halacha. I was a feminist, I was sensitive, but I was concerned about the integrity of halacha. And that's a very important point. I recently was asked on the Women's Tefillah Network, in which I correspond all the time, how come Frimmer, you were such a progressive? What happened to you? The answer is progressiveness the measure of halachic accuracy? Is progressiveness the measure of whether an argument is true or not? You have to study, you have to sweat, learn the halacha. Of course we can be creative as much as possible, but we have to be loyal to the Ratzon Hashem. I am trying to discover what Hashem, what the halachic system wants from me, and that is my ultimate guide.
I find that I hear when you speak, you are implying that people who are interested in having women get aliyot are not concerned with halachic integrity. And I take offense at that. I think that I can speak for myself only. I am very committed to halacha. I am very committed to halachic integrity. If I wasn't, I would have left this system many, many, many years ago. And that my understanding of halacha is that there can be a plethora of voices and opinions. You present halacha as if there is a right and a wrong, and that there is only one way to do things. My understanding of the halachic system in anything that I have ever read, there are numerous understandings and interpretations of each thing. You look at the Rishonim, they have different understandings of what Kavod HaTzibur is. Whether they would agree or not with Aliyot, but they have different understandings. The question of if you can be mochel kavod tzibur, nothing to do with women, there are different understandings. You can't claim that one is right and one is wrong. They are in opposition. They both exist. The Beit Yosef thinks one thing, the Bach thinks another thing. No one is right or wrong. You are presenting the issue as if there is an objective truth about the meaning of something, and that anyone else who thinks otherwise does not have an halachic integrity. And I find that very, very bothersome.
I wanted to take up a couple of points that Dr. Blau made. She said that we have to see what the broader implications of any change is going to be. What effect it will have upon the community. The implied statement is that when we examined this issue, we didn't think about the broader implications. But that's not correct. We saw, and I believe that there are many, many women, and I get phoned almost every week by new groups that are forming partnership minyanim of different types, and they are learning women, and they do consult, and they want to understand things. But I'm quite certain that if they were not given the opportunity to create these types of frameworks for them and to satisfy their spiritual needs, they would be leaving the modern Orthodox community. They would be moving elsewhere. And I think that it's most important that we keep these new models within the Orthodox framework. So it's not that we haven't thought about the implications. Quite the contrary, it's precisely because of the implications of exclusion that we are trying to be inclusive. And again, our arguments over here are very clear. Professor Frimmer thinks it's asur, and I think it's mutar. If he were persuaded that it's mutar, then he would also agree with it. So we have a basic discussion. It's not a question of integrity. I want to also make another point to Dr. Rivka Blau. The Gemara tells us that when you bring a korban, a sacrifice, you lay your hands on it. That's called smicha. And according to the simple interpretation of the verses in the Gemara, women are not permitted to do this. Nonetheless, we find in the Gemara that they permitted it kedei la'asot nachat ruach lenashim, in order to give women some sort of personal satisfaction. Now, as I've said many times, I do not believe for one moment that there was a whole drove of women that shackled themselves to the Beit HaMikdash in the first century BC or first century CE, and they said, we want smicha. We want to put our hands on this cow or this sheep. There weren't so many women that actually brought cows and sheep. They usually brought birds after they'd had a child, a birth, so and so. So apparently, it's not a matter of numbers. It's a matter of the rabbinic sensitivity to the needs of a certain section of the community. And if there are people that feel that there is this sort of need, they want to put their hands on the korban, then kedei la'asot nachat ruach lenashim, to give satisfaction, to give personal satisfaction and fulfillment to women, they permitted it. And they found a way to do it, and they found a way which is again lahatir et amutar, to permit that which is permitted. And again, what we're talking about is trying to find means which are halachically permissible to give greater ability to women to have self-expression, halachic and religious self-expression. It's not a question that I haven't got halachic integrity. I believe that I think halachically. I don't see myself as a feminist. I see myself as a halachist. You're the feminist. I'm not. I think that these things are permitted, and I've examined the sources, and Professor Frimmer, my very, very dear friend, disagrees with me. But the additional arguments that were brought by Robertson Blau are, to me, quite spurious. They're irrelevant. We have to go out of our way to try to identify those areas which are halachically provable to be permissible to women, and those that wish it and those that need it spiritually should be given the opportunity to practice that.
When I use the term halachic integrity, I think we have to understand the perspective that I have. We're talking about attempting to change something that has been practiced in Jewish tradition for two millennia.
Has not been practiced.
I mean, practicing not to do it.
But you can't practice not to do something.
For two millennia. And because of a chidush of Professor Sperber or because of Rabbi Mendel Shapiro, they're interested to change that to millennia. If I want to change, I have to make sure that what I'm doing is right. I have to, and how do I do that? I consult with the scholars of the generation and see where Professor Sperber and Mendel Shapiro did exactly what they're supposed to do. They published. They should have then waited to see what the response has been. But to encourage people immediately to go out and put that in practice, I think, is a serious problem of halachic integrity. You wait until see what the scholars say. If one of you, Rachmanos Litzlan, had to do an operation, and you did a quick Google search, and you found there's one doctor who said to do it, you wouldn't do the operation immediately. You'd get a second, a third opinion. Why, when it comes to religion, because somebody tells you that you can do what you always wanted to do, you go ahead and do it? That's not the way halacha works. I'm interested in the Ritzon HaBoreh. I'm interested in doing what is halachically right. And the way I do that is by searching for the proper answer. As far as the threat, if you don't give me what I want, I will leave modern, I will leave orthodoxy. We've been through this scenario before. We've been through the scenario. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be sensitive. And any of the things that Revinson Blau talked about was about sensitivity, her father's creative sensitivity. But to say to us, if you don't let me do what I want to, we're going to leave orthodoxy. That story we've been through with the Karayim, we've been through it with reform, we've been through conservative. Orthodoxy is thriving, and those that broke off, sadly, tragically, were lost. That's not an argument that I feel is important. It has to be. We have to be careful not to violate ahava mekalkelet teshuva. Extreme sensitivity leads you in directions of not thinking completely clear halacha.
That when the elder Rav Henkin wrote in Harpar Des that women can say Kaddish from the women's section, he said it, and everyone meant afterwards. But he didn't. He felt he should voice his opinion that he thought was halachically correct. He didn't wait to hear what people had to say. I don't understand your idea about waiting. I don't see Rabbi Sperver or Mendel Shapiro out there holding a stick over people's heads saying they have to do what I'm saying. I think that they've published their thoughts about what they believe to be true, and now people are responding, and we're going to see how the penny drops. But
my point is not against them. Against Rabbi Sperber. My complaint is against the people who jumped on the wagon before they should even have started moving. Wait to see what the response is. There are already 6 responses that are negative. 2 of them are in this book. I'm in the middle. There's going to be a very lengthy, over 100-page response that I am writing to separate published pieces. There are many, many responses already in the negative which do not support Mendel Shapiro and Rabbi Sperber. Why don't you wait before the wagon moves to see what the consensus is?
I just must mention, if you said Rav Henkin, I knew Rav Henkin, Zichrono Livracha, and I know how he was respected at that time. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who lived a few blocks away from him, said that Rav Henkin's psak was the psak he respected. So we're talking about somebody who was way, way at the top. And if he had something to say about women saying Kaddish, this was reviewed in a very, very different way by the entire Torah world, who knew who Rav Henkin was.
Yeah, they all jumped on him. They all said he was completely wrong.
No, not at all. You haven't read all the stuff.
I've read all this stuff, but I'm saying I can tell you 6. He's crying out. 6 people said this was wrong so far. You can list 6 people who said Rav Henkin was wrong as well.
But thousands of Rabbanim said he was right. That's the difference. Thousands of Rabbanim said he was right. That's a big difference. And when you say about paying attention to people who will threaten to leave if you don't give them what they want, that's why Reform has patrilineal dissent now. And look what it has done to the Reform congregations. That can't be the argument. If you don't do what I want, I'll take my marbles and go elsewhere. We can't go with that kind of argument. Also, I think your sociology is wrong. That's the major point I'm trying to make about the fact that the learned women are not looking for what you want. So maybe you know 10 women, maybe you know 100 women, maybe you know 1,000 women, but there's been no sociological study done of all the women who are currently involved in learning Gemara to ask them, are these the innovations that you're looking for? You're talking about a very small number. And to recommend that people do something, if that small number wants to do it, tov aleihem and bracha. Let them do what they would like. But be careful before you recommend it to the entire Jewish world, because there are innocent people who don't know enough who are going to do what you're saying and are going to be creating major problems in their communities with this. And you're not thinking about those ramifications. It's not just in Yerushalayim, and it's not just in whatever other neighborhood you know. It's all over America. It's all over Europe. It's all over Canada. Think about what's going to happen in all these communities. when you make the suggestion without getting approval, at least from as many people as Ralph Henkin got approval for what he was saying about Kaddish, as much as opposition as he got. I brought along something from Rav Soloveitchik that I think is really right to the point. And even though Rav Soloveitchik said it 40 years ago, it's very applicable now. And I just passed out copies of it for Rabbi Dr. Sperber, for Rabbi Dr. Frimmer, for each of us to see. And I'm just going to give the translation. I'm not going to read it in Hebrew, but I think it's very significant. And it's B'sod HaYachid VaHayachad. It's something that Pinchas Peli edited and put out. And what Rav Soloveitchik says is, we're getting a very cold presentation of Judaism these days. He said this 40 years ago, but it's still true. He said, to younger Jews, Torah has been revealed intellectually and with cold logic, but the younger generation hasn't merited the revelation of Torah with a vital feeling of the senses that will cause trembling and delight to their hearts. They know the Torah is an idea, but don't encounter it as a reality that is unmediated and is experienced with the senses, with taste, sight, touch. In other words, if you have a feeling for a Torah life, which we don't have now, it's a whole different experience, and you're not thinking of how to change it without taking very, very great care. Rav Soloveitchik says, because of this lack of a Torah sensation, the outlook of many of the young people on Yahadus, on Jewish life, is distorted. Young people in America, on one side, may incline to exaggerated extremism that is frightening in its arrogance, and I'm thinking of some of the people who said things to his wife, to Dr. Tonya Soloveitchik, that are abhorrent, and then frequently they shift in the opposite direction and agree to surrenders and to going in the path of the lightest opposition. In a word, they are confused. He uses the word nevochim, in the path of Yahadus, and this confusion is a result of a conception of the world and experience of the world that is not developed. And I think that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing a discussion in a very theoretical way, in a very abstract way, but think of the actual experience of what people are going through. Yes, there are women who feel they're being denied something by not being an aliyot. They're being denied something by not laning. Okay, let's consider their feelings. Let's open it up to a larger discussion in the entire Jewish world. But let's think of what the experience of Yahadus is for every single person. Let's think of what the approach is about how you make changes. Is it just abstract ideas? Or are you thinking about what the actual consequences of those changes will be? That's what we have to think about, and that's what Rav Soloveitchik was recommending.
So let's move to the practical. It seems to me, listening to you all, that the elephant in the room is the rapidity of change and the approbation of Gedolim. Now, to pick up on your analogy, Professor Frimmer, you wouldn't do the operation right away, but of course you would if everybody else told you that they're not going to conduct the operation for another 60 years. So I think what's really circulating underneath here, and I think that somewhere I recall Professor Sperber writing this, is that you simply can't wait sometimes for the approbation of people. Here I'm rehearsing the devil's advocate argument. You simply can't wait for the approbation of people who you know are never going to approve of this, not now and not in two centuries. So the point there is that, yes, it's beautiful to say that we're going to open this up to a public discussion, but it's obvious that there are certain segments of the Orthodox community that have waited a long time for people to espouse their view, and they're actually quite pessimistic that that view will ever, ever be championed in any place. So I think the real question here is not do we wait for people to approve, but what happens when we know they don't and won't? What happens next?
I share the need, the pain that some women feel that they're not involved in ritual. I also understand that many of them are very impatient. However, there are gedolim that you can consult. I've mentioned this on many occasions. Somebody asked me, who do you go to? Right? You're a feminist. In fact, my wife said, God blessed me with three daughters because God was saying, put up or shut up. You're such a feminine. Who do you talk to? And I'll tell you who I talk to. On a regular occasion, on questions that deal with these policies, I consult with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. I consult Rav Nachum Benowitz. I'll tell you who else I consult with, and you'll be surprised. Rav David Feinstein, who's considered one of the leading poskim. He's a straight shooter. He tells me what he feels. Hashkafically, we don't always agree, but I know I will get an honest analysis. There are a great many gedolim out there who will talk to you honestly about the sugyot. If the answer comes out to be no, then I have to live with a no answer. Because halacha is for me, the ultimate criteria. I think that, indeed, this generation has many great needs. And unfortunately, I feel I'm not in the professional rabbinate. Unfortunately, rabbis don't always take the bull by the horns. Rabbis very often try to stonewall. And on a previous occasion, which Professor Sperber and I shared, I mentioned a prophecy of Blue Greenberg. Blue Greenberg, in discussing women's prayer groups, said the rabbis are stonewalling. They don't want to deal with the question head on. What's going to happen is the balabatim are going to stop trusting the rabbis. And unfortunately, I think that this is part of the problem. There are many young, that the balabatim don't completely trust the rabbis. There are many rabbis now in the state of Israel who are re-earning their balabatim's trust. One of them is, maybe you may have heard, Rabbi Shurlo, Rabbi Benny Lau. The reason why they are considered so credible is because they take the bull by the horns. They deal with the issues. Not because they say yes, but because they give a clear analysis. They are modern. They understand the needs of the community. But the community also has to know, they also has to know K-N-O-W, that no is also an answer. And when the balabatim are willing to accept no as an answer, the rabbis will be, I think, will be more forthcoming with a proper telling the truth in its entirety.
My first comment is that I think that you should go back and read some of the tshuvot of Rav Feinberg, Rav Yechiel, and of the brother of Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, Baha Soloveitchik, because in many of their tshuvot, they rule clearly, their ruling is based on the fact that they wish to keep people within the fold. So this is not something
but
that...
But one second, the most famous ruling is the one in France right after World War II, where Rav Weinberg said that Bnei Akiva could have co-ed groups and could have co-ed singing. That's a very, very different order of change from what you're talking about.
I gave a number of examples, and I think it's worth going back to them. And I think that at that particular time, this was actually quite a radical change. But I'd like to read you a little passage from Rav Kook's itself. Heaven forbid that we should think that by permitting that which is permitted, because it didn't exist in reality, so that the custom of prohibiting it should apply. We are giving an opening to those who wish to breach the Torah, chas v'chalila. On the contrary, when people see that we permit that which is permitted, then they will believe more strongly that that which we prohibit is done because it is indeed the law of Torah. But if we prohibit even those things that have come about by means of a new invention, which never existed before, they will say that the rabbis wish to be strict on their own whim and don't care or take pity for the public. And therefore, they will allow room for greater breaches. May God protect us. This was Rav Kook's itself. This was his position, and I think it's a very forceful statement. So, again, I don't want to go into my view of the sociology of the present rabbinate. I can't go to these gedolim that you speak of, or many of them. They're the people that have tried to, and now retroactively, thousands of giurim. They've been doing things that are absolutely unacceptable. They have introduced all sorts of chumot that have absolutely no basis. Would I go to them? Certainly not. I'm not talking about Rav Lichtenstein, not Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich, but the gedolim. I studied under Rabbi Yoshe Ber, under Rav Shlomo Zalman Urbach. I don't know what he would have said if I would have sat with him and discussed it. I know that he came up with very, very interesting heterium, which if you were to hear them, you wouldn't believe it. So nowadays, the sociology of the Gdolim is such that unfortunately, we probably can't go to them.
I wanted to, since we're talking about sociology a little bit, I wanted to ask Ms. Berkovitz, you raised the issue of a kind of plethora of opinions that we define as orthodoxy. And I think part of the discussion on a meta level, really, if you break it down to its constituent parts, is what is orthodoxy? I definitely see that underneath, like, line item items like women's issues or something else, there's a struggle in the community to define itself. Like, what are we? What are its parameters? You know, any look at any sociological textbooks will tell you that communities define themselves by their borders. And if you look at studies of heresy, one of the reasons that communities actually secretly like heretics, like to seek out heretics, is because it helps communities to redefine their lines and to draw their borders, to know who is in and who is out. So if you study the history of heresy, you'll see that it's actually secretly pleasing to a community to find heresy, to be able to redefine its borders. But in any case, what I wanted to ask you, since obviously you've been struggling with these tensions for many years, is number one, how do you negotiate these tensions personally? But also, how would you define orthodoxy? For instance, you're a founding member of Shira Chadasha, right? And we know that the minyan is controversial. How would you respond to somebody who would say something along the lines with, Shira Chadasha is fine if that's what congregants would like to do, but just don't call it orthodox, which I've heard people say, right? So how far can we stretch the definitions of something without that thing losing its core identity?
Elliot gave us these questions beforehand, and I thought a lot about this question because I think it's a really difficult one for me to answer. But in answering it, what I thought about it, I want to respond to something because it directly relates to this question about talking to Gedolim. I'm going to answer this very personally. I used to be someone who did not move unless a Rav told me it was okay. I have many thoughts about women, how I thought the halacha could or possibly should be, but I wouldn't do anything unless someone said, it's okay. And I thought that the more women learned, the more their voices could be part of the conversation, and if they showed how committed they were and how firm they were and how much they accepted authority, then the rabbinate would see how serious we were, and they would listen, and they would talk, and they would think. But I reached a breaking point in my life, and that was surrounding my wedding and some of the issues I had with my wedding and my desire for there to be places where I could honor the women in my life and my family, my female teachers, the desire that my voice should be heard. I had many thoughts. I was interested in how I could participate in Kiddushin. I was interested if women could say Shavuot Brachos. The halachic issues are actually not important. And I did a lot of research on every single thing that I was interested in. And at the time, I was still close to the years of when I had been learning at Midrash Lindemann. I spoke to my different teachers about my thoughts. And every response I would get on any issue would be like, that might be possible, but if you do it, people are going to think you're a feminist. People are going to think you're conservative. All I encountered was people who were afraid and looking over their shoulders at what other people would think about them. And so I naively thought, very naively, okay, these are people that don't have the weight and the power of authority. And, you know, they're nice teachers. I learned a lot from them. But they weren't the leaders of the community. I looked back on some of the tshuva that I think are really powerful. And, of course, they're only done by people who have weight. And I thought, maybe I need to speak to people who are going to be straight shooters with me, who are going to just talk about the halakha, who aren't going to be looking over their shoulders. And maybe I picked the wrong person, but I thought I want really gadol, and I want to talk honestly. And I made an appointment to speak with Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, and I called the secretary. I made an appointment. I came. I I was dressed appropriately. I thought we were going to have a serious conversation. I was specifically wanting to talk about the women in Sha'ar Bechut. So look at the halakha. I was willing to accept the answer as no. I honestly was. I just wanted someone to really speak to me about it. He made me feel like I was not part of Am Yisrael. He didn't look and say, here's a serious woman coming to seriously discuss these issues. Why would I ask him if I didn't care about halakhic authority? Why would I be there? You feel the pain of it. I left his place. I thought I was going to cry. I thought, why am I trying so hard? But he doesn't think I'm part of Am Yisrael. He would not engage in any type of halakhic discussion with me whatsoever. And I have great respect for him. I clearly picked the wrong person. I had talked to many people. I had tried. I wrote letters to Rav Henkin about that. I was trying everything. I thought, I need to go to someone who's not going to care a little. It was very painful for me. I really felt I had no one to talk to. That's one example. There have been times, and I have much, much, much respect for Rav Lichtenstein, but when I tried to talk to him about the issue of women dancing with a Sefer Torah, and maybe it's because I'm a woman. People act, I don't know if they act differently. We couldn't have a halachic discussion. When I tried to make a suggestion about, I tried to raise Nachat Ruach, and here I felt like this is a case, we're just talking about dancing with Sefer Torah. Could we apply how women feel, the pain that they felt, during Simchas Torah, when they're standing on the sidelines, when the whole Jewish people is celebrating their love of Torah. I mentioned Nachat Ruach, he says to me, Sefer Torah is not a behemoth. And that was the end of the conversation. I couldn't even say, Behema, we're talking about Kodshim. We're talking about Milat Kodshim. It's not just the Behema we were talking about with Nachat Ruach. There was no desire to be in conversation with me. Before Shira Chadasha started, me and Judy Klitzer just had a Friday night minyan in which we had women say Kabbalah Shabbat. We tried to speak to Rav Amital. We tried to go to speak to people. No one was interested in talking to us. If I had encountered straight shooters, I would have been fine. I felt like doors were closing all over. I don't know if women asking the question is more threatening than if you ask the question, RA. But I didn't find anyone who was interested in speaking to me about anything.
Clearly, and so, my experience is very different.
No, I know. I'm just telling you. I believe it. I don't know if there's something. I think there might be something threatening. Maybe they feared what I would do with the information. I don't know. And you might look at me now and think that I'm harif. I was not harif then. I was very. I just wanted someone to discuss the things with me seriously and tell me what they thought in an honest and serious way. About how do they read this text or that text. And I couldn't find anyone who would be willing to engage in that conversation with me. And that was very, very, very painful. And made me make a choice in my life that clearly you do not agree with. And that choice was, on certain things, I'm going to do what I believe to be right and true. And I have to have self-integrity. I'll say one other thing. I know I'm talking a long time. I want to explain to you something that I feel. And this is the following. I spent many years thinking about God in this world and how can we see God in this world and what does it mean that there is a God in this world and how do we understand what revelation is. And to me, the place that I see God in this world in the most sort of obvious place is the miracle of human life and the miracle of human beings. And I honestly think, I believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created me. And if I believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu created me, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what I'm like and how my brain works and how intelligent I am and how committed I am. And then when I encounter texts that say things that are antithetical to my understanding of what it means to be a person in this world, texts that people want to say that 10 women in their midst, God is not sanctified, I find that very, very hard to believe, and I find it but hard to believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu really believes that. So I had two choices. I can either annihilate myself and annihilate my God, or I can say these texts must be influenced by social values and social ways of looking at things, and particularly texts that lean themselves to saying that. A text like Kavod HaTzibur, you can understand, even though you disagree, why there is a sound of social value being put there and not just an objective halakhic truth. And so... I don't think I'm thinking this that I'm being selfish. I think that there has to be change in the status of women if we want to preserve the sanctity and eternity and truth about Torah and God, because to say anything else, it goes antithetical to what I believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be. How did I get to that? So you're asking about orthodoxy. If orthodoxy is just looking over your shoulder and worrying and saying, I'm not that and I'm not that and I'm not conservative on that, and that's what orthodoxy is, then I'm probably not orthodox. I think of myself as a halachic Jew. I believe in Torah Chaim, a living Torah. I believe that halacha is a movement, is to work, to walk. I believe that halacha should be engaging with life as we see it at every moment, in every new situation. And honestly, I hope that many things are possible in halacha. And I believe in that because I believe in the eternity and truth of Torah. I want to say two more things. Mm-hmm. Even though I said that I make my own choices, and some things I do you might not agree with. In my home, I'm willing to do a mixed zimun. If I have two men and one woman, I'll do a zimun because I believe that is a legitimate possibility within the sources. On the other hand, I talked to you about my pain of that I actually find it hard to believe. I actually refuse to accept the idea that if 10 women gathered here, we would not say that God's name is sanctified in our midst. But yet, I do not completely break with my community. I know that, and it's to me, it's not a matter of orthodoxy. I am committed to Torah. I want to be a part of a community that's serious about Torah, that takes Torah learning seriously, and therefore I do not identify with other communities that don't. And so the community that I identify with, because I'm also passionate about Torah, is not willing to agree with me that 10 women can sanctify God's name. And so there I limit myself. And so I try to find a balance that between having self-integrity and being true to myself and to what I believe about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and understanding that I still want to identify with the community and be part of it. If you ask me what the breakers are for orthodoxy, I honestly don't know, right? I think two things can happen. The Chafetz Chaim, if you read his tshuva or some of his statements about women and Torah learning, he sounds like a conservative rabbi. He talks about the change of the times and the needs, but he wasn't. It was accepted because he was the Chafetz Chaim. It was on his power and his authority. So, clearly, if someone of that stature would say this is okay, then it would be accepted. We don't have that yet. I agree with you. And that would define what's up. The other thing that I think defines what's in and out, and it's not a matter of the, is if there becomes communal acceptance, right? I mean, we could look at the example of, you mentioned bringing in early Shabbos, right? And many communities, unfortunately, don't do that in the right way, and they don't daven mincha before a plag of mincha, and they're davening mincha and marv during the same time. Big halachic problem. But many, 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 many communities do it. And although it's not the best, if you have a really halachic community, they're going to be machbet about it. But it's become an accepted norm in orthodoxy, and people have tried to defend it halachically because a large portion of the orthodox world behaved that way, and so it became accepted. If eventually a large enough portion of this of the community is willing to accept partnership minyanim, it will be orthodox. I don't think we're at the point where we can know what will happen yet, if it's in orthodoxy or not in orthodoxy. At the moment, it's on the fringe. The thing I can say the most about the people I know is the people that I know that go to partnership minyanim identify as orthodox. They do not identify as conservative and reform. They themselves think of themselves as Orthodox Jews, and they choose to go to partnership minyanim and not completely egalitarian minyanim because they believe about themselves, no matter what you think about them, that they care about halacha and are committed to halacha and want to remain have an integrity about that. So is it orthodoxy or not orthodoxy? I don't know. I think we'll know in the future. But I hope that when we make decisions about anything, they are not about whether they're orthodox about, but whether they're permissible halachically. That's
right. First of all, I have to say that I admire your integrity tremendously, and I admire that you went to these Rabbanim
I think that one of the reasons that you were treated so in such a cursory and dismissive way is that you were asking questions about things that specifically they found very upsetting, because of something that Rav Soloveitchik mentions in the next paragraph, which I didn't translate and read aloud, but he talks about the danger of letting your own personal feelings start dominating a discussion. And I think, as wonderful a man as Rav Soloveitchik Goldberg is, and as wonderful a man as Rav Lichtenstein is, you touched on points when you started asking your questions where they felt they had to immediately dismiss it. This is not part of the universe they're talking about. And I must say, I had a very different experience, but I went with a very different kind of question. In 1980, I went to Rav Soloveitchik to ask him, in running a yeshiva high school for girls, since there were so many questions coming up then about do we emphasize career or do we emphasize motherhood and what approach should we take, and this may seem very quaint, it's 30 years ago, but that was a burning question at that time. Yeshiva high schools for young women encouraged them to go out and get independent careers. And he said to me, it's Shnei Ksuvim Hamachishim Zeh Et Zeh. And I asked him, what do you mean? And he said, on the one hand, there's a tremendous impulse to go out in the world and achieve. Everything is going to be open to women now. He certainly was a man who perceived what was happening in the larger world. And he said, the women can go out to be lawyers, they can be doctors, they can be anything they would like to be. They can be chief executive officers. So that's a tremendous temptation to go out and accomplish in the world, make your mark in the world, be somebody, show leadership. And he said, the Kasuv Hasheni is the impulse on a woman's part who wants to mother her children and doesn't want to delegate it to a nanny and wants to be there for her kids and wants to be the one who's there with them in the morning, not that she has to leave at 6:30 in the morning because there's an important case coming and she has to be prepared for it, or she has to be in White Plains and she was in Teaneck and she has to get up early and get over there. He said, so those are two things in conflict, the urge for achievement in the world and the urge to be a mother and to be there for your child and to have those years not be exclusively dedicated to, but at least in a major way dedicated to raising children. And I said, and what is the Kasuv Hashlishi Shiachriya Beinehem? If he told me there are two texts that contradict each other, how do you resolve this? He said, the ultimate resolution is the woman herself. He said, nobody can tell a woman what she should do in this instance. If she has a burning desire to be out in the world, and she'll be home with the child, and she'll be resenting the child, and thinking, if not for this kid, I could be out there being a big deal, and here I am at the park watching him go down the slide for the 100th time, that's not going to do the child any good. He will feel the resentment of the mother. And he said, on the other hand, if she's in an office, and she's thinking to herself, I'm a psychiatrist dealing with all these people's problems, but what problems am I creating at home? I'm a lawyer solving all kinds of legal difficulties for people. But what kind of difficulties am I creating at home? He said, that won't be good either. But he said, no one can tell a woman what the balance is. And he granted that a woman has a much harder time with this question than a man does. It's assumed that a man will go off, and it's assumed that a woman has to make this choice. But he said, the ultimate decision is one that nobody can make for the woman. He said, you have to open every possibility to them. He certainly believed in giving great Limude Kodesh and great secular studies, great Limude Kol to everyone. His own daughters went to Radcliffe. He was very concerned about getting a good education. But he said, ultimately, the decision has to be made by the woman herself, and it's not your place or anyone else's place to say how to make the decision. And I think if we want to think about what to do about young women who are now out in the world and able to do anything and in positions of leadership all over the place, we have to think within the community about giving women a lot of leadership positions. And we have to really think through the whole issue of Srara. Here's another halachic issue to discuss. Women's leadership, women's rule. Should women be presidents of shuls? Should women be presidents of day schools? Should women be presidents of Jewish organizations? Anybody who's ever been a president of an organization or of a shul knows it's not Srara, it's Avdus. You're a slave. But okay, women should have the right to take on that slavery also and to be the ones who are in the position of making decisions and being in charge. We have to think through the entire way we organize our shuls. Before we talk about separate minyanim and all the rest of it, and partnership minyanim and all the rest of it, let's redo every shul in the United States and Canada to have a proper women's section. I'd like to see that happen. That's a much bigger change that has to happen first. I have been in many shuls where it was impossible to hear or see from the women's section.
That's the message that's being given to women in a very direct, unpleasant way. Just quickly, 1 second, because I know my time is up. David Schatz once heard me give a talk in a shul in Queens that had just been built, very tall shul, women's section with a balcony reaching all the way back. And he came late to the talk, and it was mixed seating for the talk, and it was about the roles of Jewish women. And he ended up sitting in the back row of the women's section. And he said, "Rivka, now I know what you're talking about. I couldn't see anything. I couldn't hear anything." And he said, "I felt very, very omitted from the shul experience." And I said, "So, David, that's what we have to work on also."
I don't know how we got there, because the question was something to do with how do we define orthodoxy. And I think that Rafael Berkovich's answer was very right. We don't know. See, nowadays we have so many terms. We have right-wing orthodoxy. We have centrist orthodoxy. We have orthodox light. We have left-wing orthodoxy. And then we have right-wing conservatism and a pack of traditional conservatism, especially in Canada. And there isn't really a very clear distinction between a right-wing conservative and a left-wing orthodox. So these, unfortunately, these terms create a great deal of problems. You know, if we could get rid of these terms, it would be much better. What we're talking about, and what Professor Frimmer is talking about, is halachic Jews. Jews that feel committed to the halacha, Jews that will not stray beyond that which they believe is halachically permitted. And that is, call it orthodox, call it halachic. But Shira Chadasha, or Darchi Noam in New York, and other such institutions, the people that daven in these shuls are certainly halachically motivated. Everything that they do in consultation with somebody or other. Everything that they decide is defined by their understanding of halakha after consultation. That they are not like everybody else, well, that's true, you know. No two shuls are the same. All shuls are different from one another. And they all have different atmospheres. And one of the beauties of Judaism is that there's a great variety and you can choose what suits you. I can't daven in a Taimani shul. I don't understand what they're saying. I don't understand the accent. I daven Nusach Sfarad, and when I daven this morning in the shul that daven Nusach Ashkenaz, I keep on losing the place because I have to turn the pages over in the wrong directions. So let us understand that there was always a variety of religious experiences, to use Henry James, and not try to give tags to any of them, but just say that we want very clearly to remain within the orbit of classical normative halakha.
Rachel Berkowitz's passionate and very moving speech is what makes my life as a halakhist very difficult. Because one of my major jobs as a halachist is to be sensitive, to understand the question, to feel her pain. I sat with her. I was fortunate enough to be on the same flight over from Israel, and we sat for close to 2 hours talking about. And we speak the same language because we're both sensitive. I hope I'm sensitive. We're both sensitive and we're both deeply concerned by halacha. But with all that said, I think that Rachel gave up a little bit too easily. You should know that your conversation with Rabbi Zalman Nechemi Goldberg appears in Chumin. That is, he took the conversation seriously. And that shaila that you asked him now appears in Chumin together with the tshuva of Rabbi Yeshuni, which permitted women under certain circumstances they should have brachot. I agree that there are poskim who are not properly sensitive. And I have, as I pointed out, have found those poskim who I know who trust me and who know that I am interested in going to the right answer. But ultimately, as I've said time and time again, My highest commitment is to halacha. And unless I am convinced that halacha there's clear room to change, then I feel that the halachic integrity requires me not to walk the edge, not to take the risky, despite the pain that I feel, despite my concern for people's religious welfare.
I think there's something specific here to modern orthodoxy, and in fact it raises what I see as a central problem inside of modern orthodoxy. I'm not sure that they're having this kind of discussion in Williamsburg, but I think we have to understand the reasons why. Because we use these terms, you know, women's role in Judaism. We cite that a lot and we contest it, but it would seem that modern orthodoxy has a unique problem in this regard. Because let's look at what's outside of this domain. In secular society, to say women's role in the last 25 years, that very phrase has lost coherence. Right? Aside from biological dictates of being the one to have the baby, women in the West today, and there's tons of literature to support it, at least in theory, do not need to conform to any societal directive about what they're supposed to be or how they're supposed to live. And as time goes on, it gets less and less defined in a specific way. Conversely, in the Haredi world, right, which is not a world I know a great deal about, but it seems to me from the outside in the Haredi world, there's still more of a conception of rigidly divided gender roles. Obviously, it's changing, but it's certainly not changing with the rapidity that you see in other aspects of the traditional world. So if we can all agree on that, the question then is a modern Orthodox question, which is that once you start social change happening, and Rachel, you hit the nail on the head. You started talking about that, right? Which is that it's very hard to stop once it starts, right? Many modern Orthodox leaders will point with pride to, and we've seen it tonight, right, to the revolution of women's Torah learning and Yoatzot Halacha, to women on shul boards. But the same people are very disconcerted when the ball doesn't stop rolling exactly where they want it to stop rolling. And it moves into areas of change in prayer. And obviously, we're all aware of the fact of potential changes of women joining the rabbinate and so on. But can you stop social processes once they start? And ironically, and this is something I was thinking a long time ago and listening to you tonight only affirmed it for me, the deep irony is that the revolution in women's learning, which was so liberating in a profound sense, is actually, ironically, creating new frustrations. New frustrations for certain Orthodox women by encouraging them to become fully immersed in what was heretofore largely a male domain, with the subsequent expectations that they now would progress into other areas, like the rabbinate and so on, only to find a visceral reaction against that. So I'm interested in the question of how do you stop once it starts?
I think we have to do something totally new, and I think you can see it tonight. Rachel Berkowitz can probably learn 99.9% of the Jewish population under the table, and yet there is no title for a learned Jewish woman. We have to think of some appropriate title that will not disconcert people, but will affirm what it means to learn Torah seriously and to have the authority to speak because one has learned Torah seriously. It's going to have to be a whole new term. Of course, we're going to have to think of a whole new term in general because the term rabbi has no quality control. And now we have people calling themselves rabbi who perform intermarriages and who do all kinds of things that are so obviously antithetic to any continuity of Judaism. And we have to think of a whole new term now to describe somebody who's actually qualified to learn and to teach halacha. So I think we're going to have to think of a lot of new ways to affirm what's been happening.
Are you suggesting a new term for both men and women?
Yes.
Yes. That's a great idea.
Because the term rabbi means nothing now. The term, look who's calling themselves rabbi now. I will not go into the particulars of which movement, but there's a movement right now which permits boys after 1 year in their yeshiva, and I won't say in which town, to call themselves rabbi.
On what basis? They know nothing. And I think we have to really think through how we're using the term, what the people do, what the functions are. But when it comes to learning, we're going to have to think, and we'll have to copyright this term so the quality doesn't go down again the way it did for Rabbi. And make sure that a learned woman has a title. I'm a doctor only because of English literature at Columbia, not because of Jewish learning. And that's wrong. I think Rachel probably knows how to learn better than I do. And she should have a title. And it should be a proper Jewish title that she should have. So we have to think this through. We have to think through what the title will be for men also that will distinguish those who know. And nobody can call himself by this new title or herself by this new title who needs an art scroll or a Rav Steinsaltz or a Sansino to read a page of Gemara. If they can't do it on their own, they don't qualify.
I think that we have to appreciate that Judaism is not egalitarian. And I know that bothers a lot of people, but it stems from the fact that halachically there's the concept of mitzvot asei shezman grama, that women have different religious roles than men, just as if amongst men there's kohen, lady Israel. And that is a biblical exemption from mitzvot. And that, the distinctions between kohen, lady Israel, and between men and women, creates different religious roles. And I think that is a premise that modern man is not always willing to accept. I think that we don't appreciate that the importance of a religious role is what Hashem wants of me. Now, the problem is, and this is a very subtle point made by Rabbi Saul Berman in his article in 1973 in Tradition, it's not clear what a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants from women. Because while women are exempted from mitzvot asei shezman grama, they can do it all. It's a reshut. They can, according to Ashkenazic sources, they even make brachot. Everybody agrees there's a kiyum ha-mitzvah. They're exempted, but not excluded. And that's what we're struggling with. The fact that women have greater flexibility, they have the option to do kiyum ha-mitzvah, they have the same sanctity as men. So how does this play itself out? How do we define a woman's role? I think the Torah, God and purpose, gave women a more flexible role. But the importance of a role has nothing to do with its power, or the importance of a role has nothing to do with its covet. Take the Queen of England, for example. The importance of a role is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from me. I think the Haredi community, and we've danced around them a lot tonight, does something with its women that we in the Orthodox community don't do. A Haredi woman understands and has internalized that the fact that she changes diapers, the fact that she cleans up after her children, that she swings her child on the swing for the 100th time, that's a form of the Haftalah Re'echa Kamocha, that is the highest form of Milat Chesed, and that she is indeed doing Ritzon HaBoreh. She believes it. She internalizes it. I'm not sure that our women who are career-oriented find satisfaction, not some do, find true personal satisfaction, see their work as part, the work as a mother as part of the Avodat Hashem. I was once invited to the house of the Boshna Rebbe, and I was very impressed. The Boshna Rebbe is leading the show, and he's very impressive. But I slept over at the Boshna Rebbe's house, and late at night, I sat down next to the Boshna Rebbitzin, and I said to her, "The Rebbe gets all the covet. What about you?" He says, "Yeah, the Rebbe gets all the covet. But I serve Hashem with every fiber of my body. I serve Hashem with my muscles. And I'm exhausted, and that gives me tremendous personal satisfaction." That the Haredi world gives their women. I'm not sure that our women have learned that lesson.
You should know, Arye, everybody wants to jump in now.
Then I did a good job.
In the last 2 minutes, they've all nudged me from all sides. Anyway.
Okay.
I agree with you that Judaism is not egalitarian. But
biology is not egalitarian.
I really hate talking about women's role. I think that human beings have a role, and that's to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to do mitzvot. I don't think we need to categorize people by their gender. It happens to be that females have a certain link gender-wise, and males have a certain link, and there's also people who have brown hair, and they're all similar in some ways, and blue eyes. I find it hard to create a role based on being patur from something. To me, the word patur is a really interesting word. It means we should be chayev, but we're giving you an exemption for a particular reason. But we don't look at people who are sick and say, and so they're patur from certain mitzvot, now say that they have a certain role based on being patur from something. I don't understand. Women are not chayev to have children. Some women are unable to have children. Some women have lived many years before they have children and many years after they have children. I think anyone who wants to have children should, but I don't think we have to define women's role by that. And I don't even know if you're right. I don't know what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants me. The only thing I know is that I assume HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants me to do mitzvot. And I assume that it's a good thing to even to try to do mitzvot that I'm not chayav in, because I live in a world where I see that doing mitzvot is a good thing. And I really don't want someone to tell me it's great to change a diaper. I think it's good to change a diaper because it's good to change a diaper, and I hope that my husband thinks it's good to change a diaper as well. And that parents should be involved with their children. But I don't think being involved with your children means that you can't do mitzvot. I'm very against this idea somehow that the Torah from women has to do with children. First of all, that's not what the original sources say. We just make the original sources about her serving her husband nicer to say about children. But anyone who knows about being a mother means you balance things that you value. You value taking care of your children. I think fathers as well. You value taking care of your children. You also value getting dressed in the morning. I mean, maybe after those first few days after birth, you can't get a shower and get dressed. But otherwise, we learn to balance the things that are important. We balance our job. We balance our kids. We balance getting dressed. We balance doing exercise. Of course we should be able to balance doing mitzvot. To me, that would be the ideal value. We need to educate our women to do more mitzvot, to do as many mitzvot as possible within the halachic system, and that both men and women should take care of their kids. But to perpetuate the idea somehow that there's a different women's role and that it's okay to feel disconnected from mitzvot, I really don't agree with that.
We have 10 children. I change a lot of nappies, or diapers as you call them. I normally do the washing up. And it was never my understanding that this was my wife's job. And I also had to work out, you know, these things take time and they take time away. Most of the time I learned Torah. And I had to work out, how I divide my time. That's a question of priorities. I quite disagree with the description that Professor Frimmer gave for the position of Haredi women. Most of my relatives, my cousins, etc., are all Haredi. I look at these women with their many, many children, and they're washed out by the age of 30, 35. They don't smile. They're housebound. Some of them manage to break free. Their husbands sit in a koilov, probably don't learn very much either in many cases. Oh, we know. I'm talking about mitziyut. I'm not talking about ideals. This is what I see. And I think that it's not an ideal. It's not an ideal for women to become absolutely housebound and that should be their purpose in life, to change diapers. I don't see it that way.
Just quickly, I think that you really describe something that doesn't exist in the world anymore, because Haredi women are earning livings all over the place. And you obviously haven't read Tamar El-Or, the sociologist, who did a major study of women in the Vishnitz community and found out very different things from what you're saying, Rabbi Sperber. She found that these women were very happy with what they were doing in their lives. They were combining, being mothers of many children, thank God, and doing other things besides. You've got a false picture. Maybe you're looking at a small segment of the population. But I think a sociologist who's examined a large population
has
a better sense.
You should go to Mate Ungarn and say the same thing.
Okay.
I'm going to just pose one last question because the hour is late. Many of us in this room are parents, Baruch Hashem, parents of boys and of girls. And I'm very interested, and I'd like you all to address this briefly, what should be our educational message to our daughters, and what should be our educational message to our sons? What do we say to those of our daughters who, upon seeing their brothers lane for their bar mitzvah, also want a lane? You suggested, I think, traditionally, obviously, that Judaism has certain pre-assigned tasks. But the question is, if they experience the freedom in the secular world to fully embrace their talents, if we deny them certain avenues in their religious worlds, do we not risk them saying that Judaism diminishes their potential and their life? Do we not risk them saying, banu mikedusha chamura lekedusha kala, that they've now actually in their religious life don't get to express themselves whereas they did in their secular life? On the other hand, because I really can see both sides, if we attack the status quo, are we not sending a damaging message that Jewish tradition is biased against women? What should be our educational message? How do we socialize them? What should we lead them to expect? Let's start over here.
First, I wanted to say that I agree 100% with Dr. Rivka, who said that we have to develop new titles, both for men and for women. I think that's absolutely correct, and I think also the women must be given the opportunity to have leadership positions. They have it in the whole of the secular and the economic and the governmental world, so they should also have it in the world of religion. Your question is very difficult. It's not really focused. As I say, I have 10 children. And what happened was that we didn't necessarily find the right schools for the children, so I founded schools. I had the ability and the opportunity to do this because I worked in Misar HaChinuch. I was the chairman of the Moitzat Chemed, the Moitzat HaChinuch Mamlachti Dati, so I had the ability to found schools. So, for instance, we founded a school for women and for girls, an art school where they could study art, where they could study music, where they could study drama, and we founded a school for boys, Yeshiva Tichonit, where they learned well, which had an emphasis on ecology. That means that they didn't have to sit all day in a classroom; they could walk around. And this obviously satisfied certain needs and certain demands. Every child has different needs, and we're talking to a headmistress who has much more experience than probably any of us, and she knows that you have to tailor your educational practice to the needs of the children. But at all stages, the educational policy must be governed by halakha. When we opened the school and we had this issue of drama, which is a very complicated issue, we brought Rav Kolitz, Zichrono Livracha, who was the Rav Rashi of Yerushalayim at the time, and we consulted with him what were the parameters, how was this permissible, what they could do, could they only do it before other women, etc., etc. So, also, when we design new, innovative educational programs, we do so through consultation with Rabbanim. And at that time, there were Rabbanim that I could talk to. Now, it's much more difficult for me.
As I told you, God bless me with three daughters. So let me tell you what I did with my three daughters. My daughters all had the opportunity of learning Gemara with their father at great length. They weren't always happy about it.
I made sure my daughters were always the trailblazers. They were always, there was a chug for Gemara for the boys, and my daughters always went into the chug for Gemara. And the teacher would say, don't you feel funny about being the only girl in this special class for Gemara? And they said, no. They were always the daughters that had a Lulav and Esrog in shul and did hakafot. I trained them extensively of exactly what to do. They always made a zimun. In fact, I was in a house. I had three daughters and a son. It was always the women who made the zimun and the men answered. But they also, and they, oh, when lulav and etrog is a very cute story. My daughter Michal, my oldest daughter, would always take a lulav and etrog to the tiyul for Bnei Akiva. And the boys didn't bring the lulav and etrog. And she asked them, why not? She said, because we know you would. She had no compunctions. She is now principal of the Renanim High School, the Amit High School in Renana. And she would you know, so after the davening was over, the boys were running up for the tefillin, and nothing was happening. So she turned to all the rabbeim there, she said, give it dvar Torah, do some halacha. They wouldn't do it. So she got up, and she started giving the halacha. And she would give halacha while the boys were running up for the tefillin. And some of the boys complained, what is the female teacher teaching Torah? She says, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. And she has, for her, limud Torah, doing mitzvot to their fullest, is very, very natural. But they also know that there's sometimes no is an answer. And they know that there are limits. They know their father doesn't pull punches. I do my research very, very thoroughly. And because they trust me as a rabbinic figure, they know that they have the way of coming close to Hashem. As is clear from Rachel and from many of us on this panel, our limud haTorah is what the Rambam calls avodah shebalev. We come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu not only through prayer, not only through ritual, but through limud haTorah as well. It's a very, very important experience for us. But my take-home message is that if you want to raise your daughters, give them all that is halakhically possible. And sometimes, no is an answer.
My husband and I knew that something was happening correctly in our raising of our children, Baruch Hashem, and we thank Hashem, who certainly is the third shutaf, the third partner, in the creation of every child and in the sustenance of every child. When something happened with our son when he was about 5 years old, we were living in Chicago, and he had a friend on the block whose family was Shomrei Mitzvos, but they used to have their TV on a timer for Shabbos afternoon. When he came home one Shabbos afternoon and told us he had just watched cartoons on TV, we told him, you know, Benny, we don't want you to go to that house on Shabbos afternoon from now on. Have that friend come to our house on Shabbos afternoon. You can go to him any other time, but we don't think that TV and Shabbos go together. He said, well, are they doing something wrong? We said, no, they're not doing something wrong. But we are very lucky we got a yeshiva education, and we understand Shabbos in a very complete way. And television isn't part of Shabbos. His parents probably didn't learn this when they were younger, and they think as long as they put it on a timer, it's okay. And Binyamin was happy with that, and the friend used to come to us on Shabbos afternoon. Binyamin went to him on other afternoons. That summer we were in the country. We were at a bungalow colony. We went out for a walk on Shabbos, and I thought he was dressed properly. He was wearing blue shorts and a white shirt and a blue velvet yarmulke and white socks, and I happened to have found blue Shabbos shoes for him. I thought this kid looked like 100% Shabbos stick. And we were out on the road, and there were Hasidic kids leaning over the fence watching the bypassing parade on Shabbos, and they were wearing long black slacks, long sleeve white shirts, black velvet yarmulkes. Of course they had payas. They were wearing black shoes, and they were looking at this interesting creature wearing a yarmulke walking by, and he turned to me and he said, do they look at me and do they say, if his parents had learned more, he would keep more? My husband and I thought that was classic. We just thought that was classic. This kid understood the Jewish world completely. And I would say to raise kids, you have to raise them with a sense of you're trying to give them values. Other people have other values. You can respect those values. Understand what your own values are. And finally, something that I heard from a friend this past Tuesday when I told him that this was going to be the topic, and he quoted Rollo May, and he said, a river can flow because it has banks. So we have to think about the Torah. It has river banks. It has limits. And we have to, if we want the flow of Torah to continue, we have to respect those limits.
Okay. as you know, I'm someone who struggles. So there's also a point in my life where I spent time thinking about how do I understand Hashgacha Pratit, and does God really care about me personally? And then I conceived boy-girl twins. And I thought, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is just laughing at me. Because now I have to raise, like, in my face, a boy and a girl exactly the same age going through the whole thing. So this is something I think a lot about. You know, what when I gave him Tzitzis and Akipo, like, what am I going to give her? Like, as a three-year-old, do I take her some Shabbos candles? Like, what do I do? This is something I think about a lot. And So I assume most of our are like this. I try to be honest and truthful, and my daughter asks tough questions, and I sometimes say that this is difficult. I hope that for both of genders of children that I have, that they learn that there is value to be committed to a system, and there is value to being part of a community, and that not everything is easy, but that there's great joys and great power to be part of a community that is committed to halacha. And I hope that I am training both of them, and me and my husband together are training both my daughter and my son and my younger daughter to want to be part of the conversation. I think that I hope that one of the greatest, I forgot to mention this about women in Talmud Torah and the change, but the fact that women learn Torah, and I hope some of them learn it on a high enough level that they can, their voices can be part of the conversation, means that the conversation is changing, and sometimes the answers will be yes and sometimes the answers will be no, but it's going to be a different style of conversation. And anytime that there's something that's difficult or challenging, I talk about the fact that if you give up on it, you're out. But if you stay part of it and are part of the conversation, you can affect where the future of the Jewish people goes. And I hope that both of them get that message. And to me, originally when Elliot asked the question to us, he only talked about educating daughters. And I said, you have to talk about educating sons, because it's nothing's going to change unless we educate both genders to care about these issues. The last thing you asked about laning, before I had kids, I naively thought you could sort of plan when you were going to have kids, and I always thought I'm going to need to have all my kids around Purim time and plan the birthday. It will be like before Purim, so that for the bar and bat mitzvah, so they could just lay in Megillah and everything would be equal. And that was like my solution. I had this whole idea planned out. Little did I know you can't plan anything. But to me, I also didn't say this in some of the greatest changes. I mean, my daughter and my son growing up in a community like Shirah Chadasha, they see things very, very differently, and they have a different perspective of what's possible. We once went to a shul. We sometimes davened in a non-partnership minyan, and my six-year-old daughter said, why didn't they bring the Torah through the women's section? She, like, didn't understand. She wanted to kiss the Torah. She didn't, like, her norm was totally different than what I guess is the norm for many children growing up, and I personally am happy that is their expectation. And I would like to end the panel this. One other thing that I didn't say about significant change is really, I think that more people are talking about the issue. And it used to be that Ari Frimmer and his brother were the only people writing about the issue. And the very fact that there are panels like this, and thank God I really take it as a great kavod honor that I've been invited to speak with such wonderful people, that even if you don't completely agree or you don't know what you think, that people are interested in hearing other points of view, and people are interested in talking about it, and people are interested in thinking about it, to me is really a great change. To me, that is an understanding, wherever we are on the spectrum, of acknowledging that there's something out there that needs to be talked about, and that the Orthodox world needs to think about and needs to take seriously. And for Judaism to continue to grow and thrive in the modern world the way we want it to. And wherever we end up in the spectrum, I think that I heard a lot of disagreement, but I heard a lot of agreement here. And I really think it's wonderful that you're having this panel, that you're broadcasting it to the whole of the world, to all you people who are listening. That's one of the greatest changes, I think. And I hope that it really is going to have a positive effect wherever it goes, just because there's dialogue about it.
Just a personal note, if I may. This is my fifth interview/panel in the last 2 weeks. This is one of many, many I've done over the years. And my family knows. I thought of this panel a long time ago. I worked very hard on it. I thought of all the people I wanted to invite and researched very carefully, as I always do. And after every panel or every interview, my family always asks me, they say, so what do you think? Right? And there's a joke in our family that I'm a very hard person to satisfy. Right? It doesn't matter to me, generally speaking, what crowds think. I have a sort of internal clock about what I thought was substantial. So I want to tell my wife and children, I'm satisfied. please give these four people a big hand.
Elliot, beat me to it. I wanted to get up and to thank him. All the panels he's done in the last couple of weeks, I said it was our busiest month in history. He's really done a marvelous job. And I want to give Elliot a tremendous job to show up. And I really think, it is unique work we do, and I think really a yeshbok to everybody for coming, and we'll, keep on moving forward, keeping Torah in motion. Thank you very much. Have a good night. Thank you.